gift. Go to WILLpledge.org to make your contribution. Thank you.
Okie dokie, welcome to Media Matters. This is your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. We decided to give the band a little extended jam session this morning because beginning this week and from hereafter, we will no longer go to Media Minutes for a 5-minute 101 to 106 segment. We're just going to do the full hour with our guest here at Media Matters. I think that those of you who are used to Media Matters, to Media Minutes coming in this 5-minute segment, because it is a terrific show. I regret to say that it's no longer being produced because Free Press has decided to take its resources elsewhere, understandably, with my full support. So we'll have the whole show to ourselves. And I just want to thank Free Press for sponsoring the show and the people who worked on the show for the last 6 years for the terrific work they've done. And it's going to be a huge loss for our program, for the station, and for all of you. Let's go now to our formal disclaimer, which we do usually before I start, but this week we're going to do it right now.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Okie dokie, this is a funky intro. We'll work it out next week so it's not as lame as it was today. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Coming to you sans Media Minutes. It's going to be a full hour with us today. We have a terrific guest with you for us today, someone whose book I had the privilege of reading in galley form, and I just reread it when it came back into print. There are innumerable books now on economic inequality that have come out in the past 2 or 3 years as a global phenomenon, but especially in the United States. And the co-author of the book we'll be talking about today is our guest. I would have to say this book ranks right near the top for accessibility, interest, and all sorts of interesting insight and data and stories I was unaware of. And I've been reading most of these books, and I think listeners of the show have heard guests talk about a lot of these books. So it's my great privilege today to welcome to Media Matters Linda McQuaig, who is the co-author with Neil Brooks of the new book, Billionaire's Ball, Gluttony and Hubris in an Age of Epic Inequality. Linda McQuaig is a business reporter, a Canadian reporter, has worked for a long time at the prestigious newspaper in Toronto, The Globe and Mail, and she's currently at the Toronto Star. She's been called Canada's Michael Moore, and after reading this book, I can see why. Linda McQuaig, thank you for joining us on Media Matters.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's a real honor and a privilege to be here.
Well, as I said, the book is terrific, and I generally have books on the guests on who write books I like, because I have to read them. So that's always a given with books on the show, but this was especially a treat. I liked it so much. I'm thinking of getting all my friends to use it and read it because it really gets at a lot of interesting material. The first thing I want to ask you, though, is you're Canadian, as is your co-author, Neil Brooks.
Yeah.
The book is primarily about the United States.
Yeah, well, because the story of income inequality is, above all, an American story. Actually, the book came out originally in a Canadian version, but even the Canadian version was largely American, you know, because, as I say, the income inequality is so much more extreme in the United States than anywhere else, you know, in the advanced world. So that's just where, and so much of the sort of political narrative behind the story is really an American story.
You know, I think most of our listeners are familiar with the state of economic inequality, or think they are, and certainly everyone in America is aware that this is far from an egalitarian society. But your book, I think, is even shocking, understanding all that. And maybe, what do you think some of the, even people who think they know the state of inequality, what do you think you've got in the books? Give an example of some of the material that they probably don't know, that really should get their attention.
Well, okay. I think what's so riveting about the story is just how much it's changed over time in the United States. You know, if you go back to the period not that long ago, you know, between 1940 and 1980, you know, the often known as the golden age of capitalism, if you go back to that period, you find, yes, there was inequality, but it was just nothing compared to the inequality that's happened today. So that in the past 30 years, basically starting in 1980, you see just a dramatic shift. Like up until, you know, throughout that golden age of capitalism, basically there was tremendous growth, but it was very equally distributed. In fact, if anything, the people at the bottom end, the incomes at the bottom end, were growing more rapidly than the incomes at the top end. I mean, people often sort of think, oh, the rich are always going to get richer, that's just the way it is. Well, that is not the way it was in that early post-war period from 1940 to 1980. The rich were getting proportionally less rich. Things were evening out. But starting in about 1980, and directly as a result of real, you know, powerful lobbying efforts by, you know, very powerful wealthy interests, you start to see changes in policy that bring about dramatic differences, so that the connection between economic growth and wage growth, it becomes disconnected, except at the top end. At the upper end, you see this fabulous exuberance of incomes. But, you know, down below, where incomes were growing rapidly in the early post-war period, roughly doubling every generation, they simply stopped growing. I mean, in the past 30 years, for instance, the bottom 90%, which obviously is most people, their incomes, once you factor out inflation, have only grown by a mere 1%. But meanwhile, at the very top, the top 0.01%, like the richest 15,000 Americans, their incomes over the same time period have grown by 425%. So you just get this. I guess what strikes me most dramatically is just how that, you know, we've gone from a situation of, you know, shared income growth to this grotesquely unshared income growth.
Our guest today, Linda McQuaig, co-author with Neil Brooks of the new book, Billionaire's Ball, Gluttony and Hubris in an Age of Epic Inequality, just published by Beacon Press out of Boston. And it is a live show. If you just joined us, we didn't do Media Minutes this week. We will not be doing it anymore. It's no longer being produced, so we're starting 5 minutes earlier than usual. The number here at Media Matters, if you'd like to call in, is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And there's so much meat in the book. Let's just go through some of the issues that I think you and your co-author, Neil Brooks, raise and I think sort of systematically address. First of all, what about the argument that economic inequality, sure, it exists in the United States, but it's a meritocracy. And, you know, so the people at the top deserve what they're getting because they've produced that much value or else the market wouldn't be rewarding them.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a number of things that really bring that into question. First of all, as I was saying, you know, earlier on we had a much more equal distribution of income. So then you have to ask the question, what happened? You know, why is it that things changed so dramatically? And if you look at the what ends up happening, it's not that the members of the elite you know, become suddenly more hardworking or more talented or more innovative. What happens is that they are very effective at changing the rules. So, for instance, they manage to change the rules governing executive stock options so that they become much more lucrative, and they beat back attempts to bring in more transparent accounting laws that would have the effect of, you know, making it much more difficult for them to get away with these executive stock option increases. In the financial sector, which is one of the areas where there's been the hugest growth in income, and the financial sector is a very key part of the top 0.01% now, the change, again, it has nothing to do with those at the top becoming more productive or hardworking or talented or anything like that. It's entirely to do with the change in regulations. And you can map this out really fairly specifically if you want to. You go back and look at the regulations that governed the financial sector in the early post-war period from 1940 to 1980, regulations that were brought in the 30s as a result of the market crash in 29 and a desire to avoid that in the future. Those regulations, apart from protecting us against financial crashes, also effectively put limits on the amount that individuals could receive in compensation, partly because most Wall Street firms were private partnerships with limits on the amount that, you know, essentially by taking on debt, the people running the private partnerships put themselves greatly at risk, so they were very careful. With the changes that after 1980, of course, they pushed for dramatic deregulation of financial markets, which is, of course, very destabilizing for the whole financial system. But also what it does is it dramatically opens up the opportunities for pay at the top. So you end up with these fabulous pay packages. Essentially what they do is they manage to turn Wall Street into a giant gambling casino. And within that gambling casino, and with the regulations changed, basically there's almost no limit on the potential compensation for individuals. So you have situations like with John Paulson, the hedge fund manager, who ended up, you know, in the gambling casino of Wall Street, winning $3.7 billion in 1 year by betting against the subprime mortgage market. And, of course, as we know, in the process, helped trigger the financial collapse and all the disaster that's brought on. But well, so to see that as some kind of evidence of meritocracy strikes me as peculiar. It's an example of how the changes in the rules brought about by the people that have benefited from those changes that's what accounts for the differences.
Linda McQuaig, our guest today, co-author with Neil Brooks of the new book, Billionaire's Ball, Gluttony and Hubris in an Age of Epic Inequality, here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. And the next question is obviously rhetorical based on what you just said and what you've written. But in the United States, and I don't know if it's like this up in Canada, but in the United States, the two major political parties, the Republicans, uniformly, universally, without a single dissenting voice, argues that the problem with the economy is we have to lower taxes to funnel more money into the hands of the very wealthiest Americans because they're the job creators and they take that money and that's what makes the economy go. And the other party more or less agrees, although they don't agree as fervently. But when you look at the policies, they're voting in the same way. You argue that's bogus.
Yeah, well, first of all, there's absolutely no evidence that high taxes on the rich discourage economic growth. That's the fundamental argument of the Republicans and the conservative movement. And there's not a shred of evidence to support it. I mean, they can argue it all they want, but they can't produce evidence to support it. Because, you know, again, going back to that early post-war period, taxes were dramatically higher on the upper income than they are today. And yet, the U.S. experienced much higher economic growth all through that period. So there's simply no evidence to support that argument as fervently as they make it. But, you know, more broadly, I guess I would make the point, I mean, you're absolutely right, the Republicans, of course, are completely focused on keeping taxes low on the rich and driving them even lower. I mean, the Romney tax plan would give the top 0.01% of Americans a tax break worth on average $725,000. I mean, it's just staggering. But what's interesting is that that isn't what the polls consistently show, that what the Republicans are pushing for is not at all what ordinary Americans want. Ordinary Americans consistently show in polling, and they've shown this for years, that they want the rich to pay higher taxes. But that has simply been removed from the agenda. So this whole debate, for instance, now over things like the Buffett rule, as good as the Buffett rule is, and whether or not the Bush tax cuts should be eliminated or continued, all this kind of debate that goes on in the current election campaign, all these things, in a way, kind of amount to a kind of a small skirmish. The real matters have already been solved, or have already been resolved, I should say, in that the rich have already triumphed. They've already managed to get the vast bulk of their money right off the table. In the last 30 years, they've managed to so control the debate and so control the much of the political system that effectively the option of a meaningfully progressive income tax like we had only 30 years ago is just off the table. It's not even a subject that even gets debated in an important election like this.
You know, Linda McQuigg, I've got to ask you, you cover politics as a reporter. You know, someone who just casually follows politics in the United States, if they haven't read your book, don't, you know, really put a lot of energy into studying or following politics, if you just listen to the news media coverage of American political debates, especially in one channel, but not only there, you would hear widely that the Democrats are a party of taxing the rich and big government, even socialist, obsessed with sort of funneling money to the poor. When I read your book, I don't sense that's a very accurate picture.
No, of course it isn't accurate at all. In fact, I mean, you know, as we all know, the Republicans are the more extreme party in this regard. But the Democrats, the gutting of our progressive income tax system in the U.S. that, you know, that was there in that earlier post-war period, that would not have been possible without the virtual capitulation of the Democratic Party. I mean, for you, the Democratic Party has a long history, going all the way back to the 1890s, actually, you know, of being of defending progressive taxation, you know, and being instrumental in bringing in the income tax and bringing in the estate tax and all kinds of these things. But in recent years, since the sort of rise of the new right and rise of the, you know, new conservatism backed up by big moneyed interests, the Democrats have kind of folded their tent on the issue of tax progressivity. They've kind of folded their tent and gone home, and kind of left the ordinary American unprotected in the class war basically unleashed by the wealthy interests.
One of the things, Linda McQuigg, in the book that I thought was interesting, I've seen this before, but you had a nice discussion of it, was how sort of in a blind taste test, when Americans are shown income and wealth distribution in a variety of countries around the world, not told which country has the wealth distribution, Americans overwhelmingly say the best structure is what country?
They choose Sweden.
Yeah, 92% pick Sweden over America.
Yeah, that is a stunning study done by Michael Norton and Dan Ariely. They do these three pie charts, and they basically, you know, have people in the test, you know, choose which pie chart they want, but they don't identify which chart represents which country. One is sort of perfect equality. The other represents the equality division that exists in Sweden, and the third one is the income inequality that exists in the United States. And Americans, as you say, by a 92% margin, without knowing which country they're choosing, choose Sweden. I mean, you doubt if they would actually choose Sweden if they realized it was Sweden, because they would think, oh, that's socialist, that's bad. But in fact, that's what they like. And that actually fits with, you know, the other polling, which consistently shows that they want higher taxes on higher income people. And, you know, I mean, sure, if you just ask Do you want lower taxes? Do you want a tax cut? You know, do you want some chocolate? Do you want some ice cream? Of course, people will say, oh, yeah, I want a tax cut. But if you ask more specific questions, and if you ask questions about, you know, do you think people over a certain income level should be paying higher taxes, just by overwhelming margins, they consistently say yes. So the interesting question there then becomes, if that's what Americans apparently want, why can't they have it? Well, this is a democracy. Why is that just absolutely blocked as an option for them? So that even they don't even have a party that's actually arguing for that position.
That is almost, unfortunately, in the United States today, a rhetorical question. Our guest today, yeah. Linda McQuaig, the co-author with Neil Brooks of the new book, Billionaire's Ball, Gluttony and Hubris in an Age of Epic Inequality. Linda McQuaig, longtime political reporter and reporter in Canada, currently at the Toronto Star, formerly at the Globe and Mail. This is a live show. If you want to call in with questions or comments, the number 217-333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. In the book, a lot of the book, and I want to talk most of the rest of the show about it, you talk about the implications of this for society, for politics, of this sort of inequality. But before we get there, you also spend a good chunk of the book sort of debunking the idea that this is economically justified, not just morally wrong, socially wrong, culturally wrong, but economically, it's really not legitimate either. And one of the points you make is that the wealth that's being generated today, these great fortunes, much of it is owed not to the entrepreneur, the person who inherited the money, certainly, but to what society built up that a business could develop. I think you spent 90% is the figure you use that is sort of inherited that produces the wealth that people take for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let's just point out that, you know, a huge amount of the new money at the top is actually corporate CEOs and Wall Street people who are in no way even entrepreneurs. You know, people tend to associate big money with entrepreneurship. In fact, it's something like 3% of the top 0.01% made their money by being entrepreneurs. So we're talking about a very rarefied group, even at all. But even if you look at that group, we raise questions about why so they are, not taxed at a higher rate, basically questioning the legitimacy of how much of their vast fortunes they should be allowed to keep. And the reason for that is that, you know, of course, there is really no such thing as this sort of mythical self-made man or self-made woman, in the sense that, first of all, we're all a product of our society and all kinds of people have contributed to making us whatever we've been able to become. But even more so, there's this whole knowledge inheritance from the past, the technological inheritance that got us to where we are today. And so anybody, let's take an example like Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook multi-billionaire.
Mm-hmm. About to become a gazillionaire.
What he did was, a marginal improvement or a marginal change in a technology that had already been developed. And you can see that if Mark Zuckerberg had come along 30 years earlier, he couldn't have invented Facebook because the computer revolution hadn't taken place and the whole, everything wouldn't have been ready for that marginal advance that he was able to make. So, and don't forget, there were other people competing that were trying to make the same marginal advance. Like, in other words, the way technology works is, it develops as a body of knowledge over time, and each advance makes possible a further advance. So that, with any invention, it's really just the marginal improvement that's made. And for that, that seems quite reasonable in a capitalist system that somebody who makes that advance should get great rewards. But, I think you can also see that since a huge part of that invention, if you want to call it that, is only possible because of the vast technological knowledge inheritance of the past, that typically people estimate it's about 90%, economists estimate it's about 90%, then it seems unreasonable that the person that's benefiting benefits so absolutely massively the way they are today. And you know, it's interesting because people will often say, oh, but we need to create these enormous benefits at the, you know, this golden pot at the end of the rainbow in order to incentivize people to
Yeah, that's a very important argument. That's right.
But think about that. Do we really, really think for a second that Mark Zuckerberg, when he was struggling to make that advance, that he was thinking, now, if I become a gazillionaire, will my tax rate be 42% or 28%? I mean, it's just ludicrous to imagine that, you know, if he'd thought his tax rate would have been somewhat higher, he would have thought, oh, well, what's the point?
Yeah, I'll just get a job at McDonald's.
Yeah, I mean, it's just ludicrous. And if he did, there was the other guy that was just behind him by a couple of steps. Someone else would have stepped in and done it. So,
you know, along those lines, Linda, just the occurs to me that Warren Buffett, not too long ago, wrote a piece basically saying exactly that, saying, look, I don't even think about my tax rate. I look at, you know, how much money I can make, and the taxes don't factor into whether I make an investment or not.
Yeah, well, I think Warren Buffett has made the point that he's never seen an investor who's shied away from a good investment because of thinking about the tax rate, even when tax rates on capital gains were much higher than they are today. He says it's just not a factor. You know, so, and it certainly isn't a factor when somebody is struggling to come up with it. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the simple truth is when you actually get into, you know, when these billionaires and entrepreneurs who've made great money actually open up about their successes, it's quite striking the number of them who say that it's not even the money. You know, I mean, sure, they love being rich, but they don't even know exactly how rich they are. You know, it's the desire to achieve. It's the desire to be the best at something. It's the desire for all the psychological rewards. So the difference between Mark Zuckerberg having $13.5 billion or, you know, $5 billion is almost insignificant.
Our guest today, Linda McQuaig. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Linda McQuaig is the co-author with Neil Brooks of the new book, Billionaire's Ball, Gluttony and Hubris in an Age of Epic Inequality, just published by Beacon Press. The is a live show. We are taking callers at 217-333-9455. The toll-free line open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Yeah, since Buffett has talked about so much, it's interesting to point out that he actually owns a large share of Moody's, who are implicated in the whole collapse and the whole business. But that aside, I think that even the language we use there is, you know, earlier you said as good as the Buffett rule is. Well, it seems to me it just frames it absolutely wrong. I mean, the argument is that, or the thesis there is that why should his secretary pay more tax than he, and he should pay at least as much. Well, progressivity means that he should actually pay more.
You know what? I couldn't agree with you more, and I shouldn't have. What I meant was, because I've made the exact same point you're making quite often myself.
And you do in the book.
Yeah. In other words, in this political fight that Obama's in with the Republicans, I very much want Obama to win. Like, I very much want to have, it would make a substantial difference. I mean, they talk about something like $47 billion in revenue if you could put the Buffett tax in place. So yes, it's a small, tiny step. And, I mean, I think I made that point that, you know, the big money is off the table. The big issue of restoring progressivity is out the door. We can't even get a conversation going about that. But I guess I'm just saying, given what's happening, a little tiny step of progress to me is better than no progress at all.
Yeah, I think we should always make the broader point, though. And well, the other thing about the issue of the day is the education funding and how much you have to borrow and who's going to double the rate and how it's going to be paid for and all. But again, the bigger frame is, why should an advanced industrialized country be basing people's, or, you know, higher education on the banking system, whether it's, you know, protected a little bit by the government program that I guess Senator Simon championed and the Stafford loans. But why isn't the broader argument, you know, if you're really an education president, Why isn't the broader discussion actually ever opened?
Well, that's part of the whole problem. For instance, in the book, we argue, we look at the Scandinavian countries or and the more advanced economies in Northern Europe, and look at what they've been able to achieve with much higher tax rates. I mean, they have much higher tax rates, not just on the rich, but on everyone. And as a result, they have, just fabulous results in terms of, social equality, in terms of educational opportunities. I mean, the irony is, if you really believe in the American dream and the idea of giving your kids a chance to get ahead, your best bet is to move to Sweden. Because there they actually believe in, raising income through the tax system and distributing it broadly throughout society for all kinds of important goals in terms of creating social well-being, creating economic opportunity, just improving people's lives. The whole system with our education system here in North America, where we're increasingly loading students up with student debt, this is just a completely unproductive, unfair, just everything is wrong with it. It makes much more sense to have intergenerational transfers through the tax system so that essentially, when you're a student, you benefit, as they do in the Scandinavian countries, they have free tuition, so you benefit from the people above you, your parents' generation that pay tax. Then when you get to be a taxpayer with a proper education that's been paid for, then you pay tax and you pay for the next generation. I mean, it's just a logical system. And the system we have here is frankly ridiculous.
Are you still there, Champaign County? Okay, I guess he hung up. I didn't know if you had any follow-up on that. One of the things you do in the book, too, Linda McQuaig, that I think is really interesting, and I haven't really ever seen this before, Michael Caine, the famous English actor, made a loud comment not so long ago that, if England raised its, or Britain raised its income taxes, he would split the country because it would be, grotesque for the government to take his hard-earned money from him since he had earned it. And you made the point if Michael Caine had been the world's greatest porno actor, as opposed to a very successful actor in non-porno movies, he'd have a much lower income. Explain that argument.
Oh, okay, yeah, the story is, Michael Caine and others often threaten to leave when their tax rates go up. And in the case of Michael Caine, there was this complaint that, it was the interfering hand of the state, coming and raising his taxes that was driving him crazy and going to make him leave. And what we point out is, geez, the interfering hand of the state couldn't be a better friend to people like Michael Caine. I mean, they think of the interfering hand of the state as only applying to taxes, but it implies to the entire legal and, legal infrastructure that creates the economy. And in the case of Michael Caine particularly, look at copyright laws. Copyright laws, which are state laws, are what allows an actor like Michael Caine or any producer of intellectual property,
or any media conglomerate,
to make enormous profits. Without those intellectual property laws, Michael Caine would have no protection. For instance, somebody could take, if for instance he were a porn star, as the analogy we point out, if he were a porn star, he wouldn't be subject to copyright laws, because porn by definition is outside the laws. So the porn industry doesn't have the protection of copyright laws. So if, let's say, Michael Caine were instead a porn star, he could be the most talented porn star in the world, and he'd make virtually nothing from his movies because they could be sold freely everywhere without any kind of copyright law to protect them, to ensure that he got payment for them. So the point that we're making is that there's an elaborate system of laws, of which copyright is one and tax laws are another, and those laws make up the marketplace. The marketplace is, it's often discussed as if, we talk about free market economics, and it often sounds as if the market is governed by the laws of nature, like the laws of gravity. Well, the marketplace is actually not governed by those things. It's governed by human-made laws. And those laws, whether they're about taxes, copyright, labor legislation, everything to do with private ownership and the terms of exchange and environmental regulations, all those kinds of things, they determine how money will be distributed in a society, who will end up getting what and how. And if you change those laws a little bit, you can end up changing the distribution of income really quite dramatically. And it so happens that most of the laws work in favor of property owners and work in favor of those with means because, of course, they're able to influence the political process in order to bring about the results they want. The one set of laws typically that they're enraged about are the tax laws. And even so, the tax laws are generally very, very mild compared to what they used to be. But they don't like, they single out the tax laws as being punitive, and they imply that the income that they have before taxes is somehow natural. It's somehow the product of the natural marketplace. But we point out it's not the product of the natural marketplace. It's the product of the particular set of laws in place at this time that they've had a heavy role in influencing and putting in place.
Our guest today, Linda McQuaig, you've just been listening to, the co-author with Neil Brooks of Billionaire's Ball, Gluttony and Hubris in an Age of Epic Inequality. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. We've got another caller. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I think we need to move the discussion away from focusing on the income taxes, as important as that is. I mean, I definitely think that wealthy people should pay more on their income than people who don't make so much money. But wealthy people have all kinds of other ways, as you've alluded to, of making their money and avoiding taxes. I mean, we need to not just raise on interest and capital gains, but also reinstitute an old tax we used to pay for our wars with, like the securities exchange excise tax, where every time a stock or a bond or a derivative is traded, there's a small tax on it. And that would also have the benefit of taking away some of the incentive to treat this stuff like a casino and gamble on it, because it would take the margin away. And also things like the interest carry forward tax or avoiding taxes that way, where people invest in companies by borrowing other people's money, but then they get to, avoid paying taxes on the money they make off of that. And there's all kinds of ways. And David K. Johnson's a good author to explain how a lot of this stuff happens. But there are all kinds of ways that we need to look at gaining revenue that we're not really touching on now, where the majority of the money is. Because if we just focus on income tax, we're going to miss the majority of the wealth out there that is escaping, playing a part in helping.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, caller.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I totally agree with you. David K. Johnson is terrific, the work he's done. But let me just say, those are arguments we make very clearly in the book as well. If you've noticed, what I'm usually talking about is the importance of returning to progressive taxation. That doesn't just mean the income tax. That means the whole picture. Now, you mentioned a financial transaction tax. We talk about that in the book. It's sometimes referred to as the Robin Hood tax. And it's a terrific idea. And it's got real momentum in Europe. There's real support for it in France and Germany. And the blockage is coming from North America, ironically, particularly from Canada, but also from the U.S. And as you say, it's a wonderful tax because it applies to financial transactions. It can be set at a very small level and still have a big impact. And it won't have much of an impact on serious investors, but it has a big impact on the speculative investors that are constantly flipping and doing deals back and forth and quickly selling their things. It quickly adds up on them, and they've been very opposed to it. But, it's kind of, as you point out, it has this added benefit that it's also serves as a, you know, not only do you raise billions from it, but you also it also has the effect of kind of slowing down those financial transactions, kind of throwing, as Tobin, the James Tobin, one of the original advocates of it, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. I mean, he used to call it throwing sand in the wheels of the financial system to slow it down, to stop that wild financial speculative bubble that goes on.
Linda McQuaig, we've got a full bank of callers waiting to speak with you, so let's proceed to the phone lines. Starting with line two, Urbana, you're on the air with Linda McQuaig.
Hello. In reference to the earlier caller's comment on the cost of education today, when I was a student back in the 60s in Wisconsin, I paid no tuition to go to the university. I didn't even have to buy the books. There was a textbook library. At the end of the semester, if you chose, you could buy your books. You know, you could return them. It was explicitly a recognition that the students' efforts were not only a profit to the student, but that they benefited society as a whole. And, of course, that's the period when we had the greatest economic growth we've ever had.
Absolutely. No, you're 100% correct. I mean, it speaks to the idea that education is a public good, and it's in the broader interest of the public that people be educated, and therefore first of all, because it raises the whole educational standard of the country, makes the country more productive, but also education. Let's not forget education. Our universities are supposed to be performing this function of being centers of critical inquiry, you know, places where the prevailing ideologies of our time, you know, that we get through the media and through you know, the lobbying efforts of business and everything, that all those things will be held up to scrutiny and to careful academic examination. So this is a vital public good, and if we make, as we have, make education so unaffordable so that, ordinary people, if they end up going, incur all this debt, of course, what that makes them do is it makes them so focused on, getting some kind of job where they can pay off this burdensome debt, so that they tend to think more of corporate law or something that'll be very high-paying. We move farther and farther away from the idea of the university as an important center where we'll actually engage in serious debate about what kind of society we want to have.
Let's go to our next caller now. Line 4, Peoria, you're on the air with Linda McQuaig.
Hello. One of the obstacles to changing the tax system, I think, is like, for instance, the Fox News and the Rush Limbaugh people. And the people that I know that listen to those sources of information are, maybe it's just the people I know, they're down in the lower end of the economic ladder, and I know you're Canadian, but I don't know, maybe it's something about our culture, and I wonder what your thoughts are on that kind of phenomenon.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is one of the perplexing things, is the extent to which the Republicans, the whole conservative movement, has managed to get a lot of votes from people whose interests they are absolutely destructive towards in their policies.
Now, do you have that sort of thing up in Canada, Linda?
Yeah, we do. We do. I think it's more pronounced in the States, but we are seeing the same kind of thing in Canada. I mean, obviously, to a huge extent, it's media manipulation, and there's also, it's interesting. Like, there's some interesting work done by Larry Bartels, a political scientist. I think he's at Vanderbilt University. And what he's done is studied over time, the way political attitudes on the part of ordinary people, and showing how little impact they have on the political choices made in Washington. So that, in fact, the people at the upper income level, he's shown their voices are actually heard to a certain extent in Washington. You know, in the top third, the Washington votes reflect, in Congress, reflect their ideas. The middle third, less reflection. The bottom third, no reflection at all. And then there's some other interesting work done by political scientists, Hacker and Pearson.
They've been guests on the show.
Oh, have they? Yeah, they're terrific. And
yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm sure you know their point, that basically, you know, political attitudes towards things like the role of government and the economy have not changed, generally speaking, in American politics. Yes, there's been this huge Republican takeover of politics in many ways, but that's more because the Republicans have been effective in exploiting some of the social issues, and not because people have moved to the right economically and on the role of government.
Let me ask you a question about religion. In the United States, one of the interesting developments along these lines in the last two decades or so has been an element of Christian church or Christianity has sort of adopted these sort of economic policies you write about in the book of low taxation on the wealthy and sort of presented them in religious garb as if this was somehow something from the Sermon on the Mount. And, you know, I'm not an expert at religion, but until this happened, I would have thought that would have been impossible from what I do know of the Bible.
Yeah, and obviously there's the whole tradition within the Catholic Church, which, well, it's a bit of a sub-tradition within the church, but there's the sort of progressive tradition within the Catholic Church, which argues for, you know, much greater, you know, higher taxes, basically, on the rich, social justice.
No, that's the existing policy of the Catholic Church today, internationally. I mean, it's not some distant past.
Well, okay, but I'm just saying, in terms of what they actually get out there and fight for, I don't think we hear so much about
no,
that.
Not
but,
in the United States.
But there certainly is that tradition within the church.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very strong. And it's obviously quite at odds with, you know, as you say, the kind of evangelical thing today, which is, you know, but again, I think what goes on there is that I think the right has simply been extremely effective at kind of making those social issues and religious issues to do with, you know, everything from abortion, gay rights, that kind of thing, making those into issues and appealing to voters that are very hostile to those kind of modern new world developments, contraception, all that kind of thing, and getting them to vote along those lines and taking the focus away from the fact that, in general, you know, the policies favored by the Republicans are not in their interest.
Linda McQuaig, I think we should get back to these callers. I want to make sure I get all three of the ones who are currently waiting on the air in the next 10 minutes. Let's go to line three. Urbana, you're on the air.
I have hopefully a quick question, kind of a history question. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes.
These days, you know, in the modern era, if you're not taking home 100 million, hundreds of millions, even a few cases, billions of dollars, you're not considered, you know, the truly, truly rich. But back in the American heyday, we were talking about earlier, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s. I don't know if you have these numbers available to you at hand or not, but what would it have taken back in, say, 1965 to have made you a really rich person? What kind of income would that have taken then versus the kind of astronomical income that people have now? I mean, it seems like back in the 60s, 70s, they were very wealthy people. They could do what they wanted. They could travel. They had big homes. But now I would think that, in comparison, they wouldn't even hold a candle to what we can.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, thank you, caller. Go ahead, Linda.
I don't have the exact numbers right in front of me right now, but you're absolutely right about the trend that in fact, back then, there were rich people, you know, but the gap between the top and the bottom was nowhere near what it is today. I mean, and you can see that in those kind of statistics that I'm sure you've seen reflecting, let's say, the gap between the average CEO back in the 50s and 60s and the average worker at something like 40-1 back in the 50s and 60s, and something like 380-1 today. And actually, if you go into the financial sector, the gap is even huger. You know, you look at somebody like that John Paulson guy, the hedge fund manager, the gap between his income, you know, in 2009 and the average worker was 82,000-1.
I guess he's a productive guy that year.
Well, he's actually productive in helping trigger the world financial crisis.
Well, yeah, if you bet against for it, I guess, if you're playing the odds. Well, whatever. Let's.
But I just want to, because I think the caller's getting at a really interesting point here, and that is that, you know, there was inequality back then, but it's nothing like the inequality today, and that that reflects just sort of changing cultural attitudes as much as anything. That back then, there wasn't the same kind of encouragement of greed. There was a sense of, a bigger sense of kind of the social contract in society, the compromise between having a capitalist economy and having programs that sort of mitigate against the worst excesses of capitalism.
Well, I think I'm from that generation that came of age in the 60s, as I think you were. And in the United States, at least, I mean, people who were spectacularly wealthy, I mean, they weren't flaunting it. I think they sort of understood that it was sort of weird that someone would be so much richer than someone else if they're both working hard.
Yeah, and the truth is, I mean, the studies actually show that, you know, what people really want is not, you know, they want to be relatively well off compared to others. Like, in other words, psychological studies show that what matters to people is their status in the pecking order. And so if you're at the top of the pecking order, but the whole pecking order has collapsed to a lower level, you can feel pretty darn terrific at the top of it. So by sort of pushing it so that you have this huge, huge growth at the top, you're not even necessarily making people even any happier up there. It's just become, the you know, now the sense of having made it only clicks in at a much higher level. When we had these top high tax rates, like in the 50s and 60s, the top marginal tax rate for some of those years was 90%, which effectively meant that, you know, above a certain level, and it clicked in at a high rate of income, essentially, the government was taking virtually everything you got. So you would think, well, that must have discouraged people, right? People must have had no incentive at the upper end to bother working. But as we know, in fact, those years were highly productive. Our economy was booming. And so I think what it shows is that having that upper limit simply just set the standard about what one could aspire to. And instead of, you know, people work just as hard, and now that the tax rates have fallen so much, what's happened is it's not that people work any harder at the upper levels, it's that they focus more energy on generous compensation packages for themselves.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest, Linda McQuaig, the co-author with Neil Brooks of Billionaire's Ball. Let's go to line one, Savoy. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, I guess it is.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for the host, a comment for the audience, and a question for the guest.
Okay, why don't you start with me?
I can get them in quickly.
Okay.
I should explain that I try to take the pulse of the nation by listening to many different programs across the week, and sometimes this changes according to which state I'm in. And I'm glad to hear that the guest is from Canada. That should expand my knowledge base here. Now, the question to the host is, how national is Media Matters? Are you the same Media Matters that I hear Rush Limbaugh comment about in the last couple weeks?
No, we're not. We are not national. We're on WILL AM 580 here in Champaign-Urbana, but we are podcast, and we're available on the web and streamed. And we have probably as many listeners, I'm guessing, and I don't have the exact statistics, who listen on a computer, wherever that might be around the world, or an iPod, as we do who listen live over the air. So we have and we see Dream Pledge drives and occasionally get callers from all over the place. We have a lot of listeners outside the area, but we are a local show to East Central Illinois.
So you may or may not be the Media Matters.
No, in fact, Media Matters comment that Rush Limbaugh criticizes is a Media Watch group set up by David Brock in 2004 which is sort of fact-checks conservative media.
Where are they headquartered?
I think they're in Washington, but we have no relationship whatsoever. In fact, their name is Media Matters for America to distinguish themselves from this show. They were originally Media Matters.
Well, so you were first, I guess, then.
I guess I'm an old man. I guess that's something, benefits to go with age.
Now, my comment is for the audience, and particularly children who may be choosing to listen, or maybe they're a captive audience because their parents are listening. I wish to comment that everybody should remember that when comparisons are made to some of these itty-bitty, teeny-weeny countries in Europe, that's not really comparable. There might be some great ideas that come here and there, but it's not really comparable. They don't have so many groups, and therefore the society is more homogeneous, and it's much easier to get people to feel good about some kind of program that's going on because there's not so many groups and with ones trying to take advantage of the other and all that sort of stuff. My question for the guest is, my pre-college education has left me with the idea that most of the United States of America's great leap forward kind of genuineness occurred in the middle and late 1800s and the early 1900s, and that's when we pulled even and maybe began to go ahead of some of the other global powers at the time. Can the guest give me any validation for that? Or
okay, well, thank you very much, caller. Linda McQuaig?
You mean in terms of global competitiveness?
I think just that that was the glory days of the United States advancing as a power in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously it was after the Second World War that the U.S. becomes the dominant power in the world. Before that, of course, Britain was a bigger force. But, you know, it's a gradual thing. Certainly, the U.S. is starting to become a potent force in the world in the late 19th century and early part of the 20th century.
Let's go back to our final caller now. It's been waiting patiently, assuming they're still there. I'm hoping they are. Line 2, Champagne. Oops. I guess maybe Line 2, Champagne is not there after all. So, I guess it's just on to you and me, Linda, at this point. And are you there, Line 2?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, that was me.
Okay, well, I guess it's just
line
us again.
Line 2 there.
You know, we've only got about a minute or so left, and a large part of the book that I really enjoyed talked about the social dilemma of inequality and all the damage it does in terms of empathy, in terms of mental health. And maybe just say a word or two about that so it's not just sort of a technical issue about who gets a bigger slice of a pie.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, well, there's just some remarkable work that's been done on this. And, of course, there's the wonderful book, The Spirit Level, by Wilkinson and Pickett, that looks at this whole question of the impact of inequality on the social and health well-being of citizens. And I guess what the evidence finds is it's just overwhelming that more equal societies just have way better outcomes in terms of a wide range of, you know, health.
You know, on that note, Linda, unfortunately, I got you launched off in that because the band's tuning up in the background. Geez, they want to clear me out of the studio.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for taking an hour out of your Sunday to join us, Linda McQuaig.
It's been a great pleasure, Bob. Thanks very much.
Sure thing. Linda McQuaig, co-author with Neil Brooks of Billionaire's Ball, Gluttony and Hubris in an Age of Epic Inequality. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board, Christina Williams for being my producer. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with Janine Jackson from FAIR. Until then, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Mostly cloudy skies in Champaign-Urbana today with a chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms this afternoon, the high around 63. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a 50-50 chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low around 47. Then tomorrow, cloudy with a 50-50 chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high around 70. And Monday night, mostly cloudy, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low about 55. This is WI.